Anyway, the grandfather of Wilderness Awareness School tells a story about how the monkeys and the bird language saved his life during a time in Kenya when there was a particularly wanted man who was known to be a murderer, who had been captured and then somehow managed to be either he escaped or he was released, and they had to capture him again. Ingwe was following him with a group of constables, and they were tracking him through the brush when all of a sudden Ingwe, because of his training as a hunter-gatherer, had tremendous awareness. He was suddenly aware of bird alarms and monkey alarms behind him that he recognized would only be made by the approach of a human being in a sneaking position. And as soon as he heard that, he realized that they had been set up, that they were actually following tracks that were leading into a not so much an ambush, but this criminal was actually now going to come up from behind and waylay them from behind while they thought that they were stalking forward. But because of the alarm that he got from the monkeys and the birds, he was able to alert all the other constables, who had totally missed it, by the way, who hadn't even been aware, who hadn't even been perceiving that there was anything behind them at all, because their focus, their training was to follow the trail. You know, like that's how we are in modern life. We're always taught to look ahead and only to follow what's right in front of us. So they didn't notice that subtle change in the bird language behind them. And so because of that, Ingwe was able to warn them, and they hid on either side of the trail and fell back into the brush quietly, and they were able to ambush the ones who would have ambushed them. So he talks about how this knowledge has saved his life, you know, and this is something that he learned from the Africans. And actually, we say learn from the Africans, the hunter-gatherers, the Akamba, but if you really think about it, it's not so much the people that teach this, but it's the animals themselves that teach it, because as Gilbert emphasizes, I emphasize, Tom Brown emphasizes, Ingwe emphasizes, it's necessary for you to go alone into the forest in order to learn this stuff, because it's the animals that are your greatest teachers. And so I guess the role that we play as mentors or coyote teachers is more to keep the young people and the students that we train inspired enough to keep them out there alone and to encourage them and to help them process their experience and to take them ever further. I remember one of my younger apprentices years ago, Jeff. He was, I guess he's been around probably the longest of all the students I've mentored. I started working with him when he was 16, and that was in about 1983 or 84. Jeff was out wandering in the forest, and I was sort of demonstrating to him that I was able to always shortcut the deer. You know, that when we were in the woods and the deer were moving from here to there, if you follow the deer, they'd always do a little trick, which was to sneak. Let's say you're walking south to north and the deer are ahead of you. They'll always kind of sneak off, let's say to the west side of you, get behind a thicket, and as you pass them, they'll quarter behind you. They'll sneak off to the southwest, if you can imagine that. Okay, so imagine yourself walking through the forest on a south-north line. You see the deer ahead of you, and they kind of ditch it to the left. It means going west, and they kind of hide in the thicket. And but the illusion is that they're running forever because they wave those big white flags as they're bounding off, and then it seems like they keep going and going. But what they're doing is just going just out of sight and then dropping their tails. And the illusion that your mind picks up on is that they're still going, and they're still going further and further. By the time they get out that far, you can't really hear their footfalls as clearly anymore. So they know just exactly how far to go in order to pull this stunt off. It's kind of like they're masters of illusion. They drop their tails and they get into a sneaking posture and they head southwest. So they kind of quarter behind you and away. So they're putting distance from you in two directions. You know, they know, okay, let's get further away from their line of travel as well as go in the opposite direction. So they're maximizing the distance from you that they can get by doing that. So I figured that out quite a long time ago, and it was the blue jays that taught me this. And because as soon as a deer assumes a sneaking posture, first of all, when the deer are bounding and waving those big tails, that gets everybody's attention, not just mine. But the jays that are in the area immediately see that and zoom right in. I mean, I don't, for some reason, jays love a party, and waving deer tails and bounding sounds calls them right in, and they come straight over there. And they create this big racket when the deer start bounding, and the chipmunks all go off, and there's this huge explosion of sound. And then the deer slow down, and they drop into that sneak posture. And they literally bend their legs, and they get down low, and they kind of sneak along. I mean, that's what they're doing. Their tail's pulled tight up against their butt, so no white will show at all. And in that, what we call a ghosting gait, they move along for quite a distance until they feel that they've put enough distance between you and them. And at that point, they relax and start to walk again. Well, the jays are right in on them. As soon as they start sneaking, the jays just go, sneak, 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 in this really intense manner, you know, and it's pretty obvious once you figure it out. So I told Jeff about that, and he didn't believe me. Ah, oh, you can't know that, he said, you know, and he headed out into the woods we know as Thompson Park over there, and he attempted the same thing when he spooked up some deer. And he heard those sneak calls, and he did what I told him to do, which was to head in the direction where that southwest trajectory was going, so to speak. You know, that you hear the jays going off, so you know where the deer are headed. Just kind of use your knowledge of place, know the landscape. And he knew that landscape very well. That was his secret spot. You know, where are they headed? Use your mind to tell yourself, you know, where on the deer trails do you think they're going right now? And just get there yourself first. And so by doing that, he was able to see a buck several times. You know, get there first, and the buck would cruise by him. It's the same trick I used with that gray fox that I told you about on the other tape. So knowledge of bird language, knowledge of place, this all adds up after a while. I think you really have to know your place very well for this to work, you know, totally awesome. But I think about, for instance, you go into an entirely new landscape. In our independent study program, the Kamana program, I have an exercise about this. We call it the Scout on the Porch. You know, when you train your mind to see and to perceive and to pick up information and to store bits of information, and the way you train it is through the journaling process that I've already described to you. You know, you train your mind to be more or less photographic, not only with images, but also with sounds and with dimensions. You know, so all of your senses are involved in your journaling process. You develop a really strong ability to see and remember, like Sherlock Holmes. Okay, but also, if you know all the birds of your area and you know the habitat that they live in, which is part of your goal as someone who's learning this stuff, when you get into a place you've never been before, it's not hard to figure out that there's a swamp just beyond the tree line. So you come to a new place you've never been there before, and you look out across the way, and you notice that the trees sort of end and there's some sky over there. You've never been here before, but from this point of view, you can say to yourself, well, right away, there's either a meadow over there, a body of water, or a river passing by. And then you step out the door for a second and you listen, and you hear the sounds of a certain kind of a shorebird, a little sandpiper that makes its nests in the gravel bars and along rivers, right? So you, having never been there, might know there's a river over there, right? Not only that, but you hear that little bird kick up and fly off and give a bunch of alarms. You recognize that alarm as the sound of a coyote moving. So the person who's living in the house, you tell them there's a coyote moving over on the gravel bar over there, and they haven't even been to the gravel bar yet. You know, so that's the kind of stuff that scouts are capable of, because they're using the bird language to tell them about the landscape. You know, a flight of swallows in a particular area indicates a lot of things too. It tells you, depending on what kind of swallows you're looking at, you know there's a bunch of hollow trees around. Especially if you hear those swallows hovering around and twittering their nesting sort of territorial calls in amongst the sounds of yellow-shafted flickers, or in the case of the northern flicker on the west coast here. You hear their calls together, you know, okay, there's a stand of dead trees over there. So bird language isn't only used by the scouts to indicate the approach of danger. It's also a way of knowing what's around you, knowing your landscape in three dimensions in all directions, even beyond the line of sight. And that feedback works in the opposite direction too. If you know it's the kind of warm day, you step outside of your lodge in the morning and you know it's the kind of warm day when all the insects are hovering around. As a matter of fact, you look and you see the insects all flying around you. And you say, okay, this is one of those days when all the little birds should be feeding on insects. But you don't hear a sound from all the flycatchers that live there, and you don't see the swallows buzzing around right at that moment. Everything is silent in that patch right over there. What do you know? What should be happening isn't. So right away you can assume who threw the switch. And if you think about it, aerial flycatchers who aren't feeding when they should be, there's only one thing that could have triggered that, and that would be a winged predator, especially one of the accipiters, like a sharp-shinned hawk or a goshawk. So these are the kinds of things that bird language teach you. If you know the birds and their association with the landscape really, really well, and they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, that's information also. So that's how all this begins to fit together over time. Okay, so you know where the pond is and you see the wood ducks winging out of there in a hurry. That's a message. You know, don't ignore it. So these are just some of the little stories I have from the past that kind of relate back to the scout tradition, how they use bird language specifically. Okay, let's go back again. I'm going to answer a question that someone asked me earlier. You know, I'm coming out of my cabin in the morning and the chicory, which some of you might know, similar to the red squirrel that is all across North America, the little squirrel that drove Dave Franklin crazy. That particular squirrel is out on a branch or on the side of the tree making this hellacious racket for long periods of time. Are they just doing that randomly? You know, why are they doing that? Well, my answer to that is because of the conservation of energy. Nothing is random. Birds never make intense vocalizations without a really good reason. Squirrels never make vocalizations without a really good reason. The question is, do we know enough to answer the question? Why are they doing that? You may not know. You might not know. And sometimes these answers take you years to figure out. I mean, I know a lot of times certain bird language information that I gained the hard way. Sometimes I was working at that for three or four summers before I finally said, aha, I know what this means now. That's how that knowledge comes to you. You know, it's hard-won knowledge. It's hard-won. And the only way you're going to know what that squirrel is really saying is by putting yourself into its world. You know, you're looking at that squirrel every day. It lives right outside your cabin. You're in a perfect position to answer that question yourself. But you have to use what we were calling yesterday that self-analysis or the sacred question process. What have I observed? I've observed this squirrel making this hellacious racket, right? And you have to really start to get specific. What kind of hellacious racket? You described it as, which call was it again? Yeah. Call, yeah, and he just keeps doing that. Okay, so what have I observed? I've observed a chicory with that call, you know, and on that side of the tree. And I noticed that it seems to be related somehow to me, maybe, but you say now it's not related to you, so you've seen a change in its behavior. You're doing the right thing. Ask yourself, what is this telling me? You know, well, we know squirrels don't just make noise because energy is hard to come by out there, right? So that's, think about you hanging on the side of a tree and going for an endless period of time. You know, you're going to get really tired from that and you're going to get hungry, you know. So why is it doing it? There's some investment going on there and you got to figure out. So that's the question. What is this telling me? If you can't answer that, you just have to keep asking why, what could this be telling me? And, you know, there's only a few possibilities. It's either alarm or it's territorial behavior or it's psychotic behavior. The squirrel ate bad mushrooms. Now, but only in time are you going to be able to answer that question, but you're in a good position to do that. All right? And then what is this teaching me? I mean, the deeper teaching here is the one that I've already derived out of it, and that is that these animals just aren't random. You know, these sounds aren't just random. What it's teaching me is that I need to pay attention to every such intense sound around me for sure and get to know the meaning behind them. You know, and eventually the lessons get deeper and deeper, you know, as you go down that profile. So we think back again to that deer, that ancient buck, and the energy conservation question. You know, I think it was it Paul Hoftling? Did you observe yesterday or a couple of days ago that Merv, you know, our friend Merv Wilkinson, he has such peace of mind. Was that you that said that? Because he's living that lifestyle of the caretaker of a forest. He doesn't have all the stress that we all experience you know, modern life and modern interaction with cars and traffic and insanity. You know, he's got this ideal lifestyle, living on this island in the beautiful Northwest forest, you know, just living his dream, caretaking a piece of land. So he has total peace of mind, right? Well, we can't underestimate the value of peace of mind. And I want to think back now to our friend, the ancient buck, who walks slower than everybody else. you know, maybe he's arthritic. No, he's not arthritic. He is conserving energy to the max, and it's not just because he's moving slowly. Think about peace of mind and how it relates to his choice of gates, and you'll understand energy conservation in a different way. He's not just conserving energy by walking really slow. We know that that conserves energy, right? When you're walking fast and you get tired, you slow down and you rebuild your energy again, and then you walk fast, you get tired, so you walk slow. So walking slow does have a benefit that way. But there's more than that. That deer has figured out that the deer that we all see every day, the 18-month deer, the adolescent deer, if you will, the one that, because it sees danger, it gets spooked and goes taken off in a hurry, right? Its heart rate increases. It has an adrenaline rush as a result of panic. Do you get that? Think about the times you've panicked. Think about, here's an example. If you're a person who's ever experienced college final exams, or maybe high schools do that too, final exams, you know, what is the amount of panic that we experience during final exams? Can you think about back to the days when you've taken a final, or maybe some of you are in the middle of them right now listening to this, when you have to put so much intense mental energy out, and you're so tense and anxious about the results of this and what it means to you. There's so much intensity around it. When you're done, I don't know about you, but I am both whooped and starving. You know, I could chop wood all day and develop an appetite, but I'm never as tired from chopping wood as I am from experiencing something like a final exam or a production deadline, right? Because mental energy and anxiety is a greater consumer of your body's resources because of the adrenaline rush associated with it. The fight or flight response is exceedingly expensive to the body's metabolism. It's very expensive. So the more fight or flight experiences that you have as a wild animal, the more you burn up your precious resources, the less likely you are to make it through the winter. The case in point is really well illustrated by the big elk. You know, the master elk who ends up being the herd master who gets to mate with all the does. Mating is also expensive, but I guarantee you that just as expensive to all the mating that that buck is doing is all the fighting he's doing and all the stress and anxiety he experiences fighting off all of his would-be foes, all of his competitors. He's in a constant state of fight or flight, and it is pretty well statistically proven that that huge, majestic, vital, and powerful bull, the symbol of health and vitality for his whole herd, is the one who's likeliest to die when the winter sets in, because he will have used up all of his bone marrow reserves. He will have used up all of his fat, and he won't have time to really rest, get his head together, and eat a lot. You know, so even during the time when he's in all the stress, he stops eating. Does that make sense? So I want you to think back now to the buck that's walking in what we would call a 1-minus or a sub-baseline gait, the gathering information gait, versus the deer that are running through the forest sort of in a blind panic. They're the easy targets. You see that? They're the ones that the hunters with the shotguns can get real easy without even having to be a scout, because when a deer panics and takes off and runs and a hunter's got a shotgun with buckshot, it's an easy shot, right? It's kind of like shooting moving target. But I mean, the deer that were brought in that day had broken legs and they had holes in their chest and in their butts and they were shot every which way. You could tell that these guys were shooting at fleeing deer. But it's very similar to the way a song sparrow, it kind of helps you understand why a song sparrow, when you spook it, if you're a cat moving through the brush and that song sparrow has to leave the bushes to get out of your range, it's not likely to just fly blindly off in a panic across the field to get away from you, because that puts it at great danger. You know, it becomes a moving target. So the wise song sparrow, when it sees the cat, only goes high enough. You know, you were asking about that junco. It might just be that that junco will get away with that for a little while. When the cat goes by and that junco goes way up high like that, maybe that junco isn't going to be there next summer. You know, maybe it won't even make it to the end of this summer. You know, so there is wisdom in the animals that's relative. You know, that the ones who learn not to panic, but instead to take everything in stride, to take a long look at stuff, and to walk really slowly towards things. You know, we call that wisdom, I think, in our society, that kind of approach to life. Says, oh, here come some people. No big deal. I've seen people 1,000 times through here before. They never leave the trail. And when they do leave the trail, they make so much noise that I know I have plenty of time to hide. And I can hide within 10 feet of them, and they won't see me anyway because they're not really looking. You know, that's what that buck figures out through time. So energy conservation is involved in that process of walking really slow, not just because it's more relaxing to walk slow, but also if you don't allow yourself to fall into panic, you conserve the energy that would be used up in fight or flight. So does that make sense to you? So that's why it's really powerful for an old buck or an old doe or an old bear to develop that kind of lifestyle and to really hold their resources. They symbolize what that whole, you know, everyone's fascinated with Star Wars, what the Jedi represents, you know, that whole kind of training to be in the moment, to let things roll off and to stay in the big picture, to trust the force, you know, the instinct, the feeling, and to not allow your mind to get away with you. You know, that's the whole symbol of that, you know, this kind of training. So I'm just going to give you guys a quick rundown. We learned some really important lessons as trackers working in Western Washington for the Department of Natural Resources in the South Puget Sound District in a place called Tiger Mountain, Natural Resource Conservation Area. And there was a whole bunch of us working on that project. In fact, in the audience today, about half of you were on it, so you remember this well. I remember talking to people on the, and I'm not talking about the trackers now, I remember interviewing various people who we encountered on the walking trails. These were people who hiked Tiger Mountain regularly. And I remember looking at the newspaper clippings and talking to the area manager about sighting records. You know, every time a bear or a cougar is sighted at Tiger Mountain, people are asked to record it in a logbook, you know, and just from gathering anecdotal information from the people who go there regularly, I guess we spent about 4 months doing this, I got pretty clearly that bears were sighted only rarely at Tiger Mountain and that cougar was seen every once in a while. Okay, so if you had taken that information on face value and said to yourself, well, there's only maybe one bear that visits Tiger Mountain occasionally and a cougar occasionally, you would assume that that's it, you know, that those animals aren't any more numerous than that and that the cougar is not a stable visitor. Well, the results of our tracking survey proved just the opposite. And so there was a bear during the time we were there that was getting a lot of press. It was a 2.5-year-old male bear that was going into the local town of Issaquah knocking over bird feeders and garbage cans. And that was the bear that was showing up, that was kind of coming and going from Tiger Mountain. So the assumption might be to the public, well, there's one bear that lives at Tiger Mountain, a 2.5-year-old, who kind of goes out into the suburban neighborhood to foray and then to go back into the woods at night or into the daytime where it can hide. Well, that's a true assumption that bear is leaving Tiger and going out and coming back. But the thing that isn't true is that it's the only bear. And what we discovered in the little area that we were tracking in, I think about a 4,000-acre area, we discovered the identities of 7 individual bears by the size and shape of their foot, by the length of their stride, by the habitat that they were holding, by the territory that they were in. We identified 7 individual bears in that patch of woods. So when you look at the sighting records and you say, there's 1 or 2 bears seen a year here, right? Maybe like that. It just makes you realize that probably out of those 7 bears, maybe 3 of them have been seen by people recently. And perhaps 4 of those bears will live out the rest of their life, and some of those bears, 25 or 30 years, without ever having to lay eyes on a human being. Simply, they can choose whether or not they wish to be seen or not, black bears. And I'm talking about, you know, 300 to 500-pound animal, right? We're not talking about a mouse here, you know, we're talking about a very big animal that has the ability to entirely and utterly elude detection. And it can live right under the noses of people on the edge of suburbia, just like that, and never be seen. You know, this is the ultimate knowledge. And I look at that because as a tracker, I see their tracks all the time. I know these animals are out there. And I just want to remind everybody on a continuing basis that this is what bird language ultimately teaches you. You know, not only that they're out there, but that you could develop the same skills of stealth and awareness that they have by learning from them. And how do you learn from them? Just by doing all the things that we're talking about here over and over in 100 different ways. You know, just get out there yourself. Think about that old buck, because, you know, I like to look at that particular state of mind that that old buck develops as cougar medicine. You know, that buck moves more like a cougar does than it does like a deer. Because if you look at a herd of 100 deer, how many of them develop that kind of wisdom? You know, if you look at those deer that were in New Jersey, 273 of them were brought into me from one district. How many lived? You know, how many were left behind? I'm saying a very relatively small percentage of the population probably develops that kind of wisdom. So you can think about that with the bears too, that we call that cougar medicine, because I sort of write it off as cougar medicine, and actually maybe I should call it leopard medicine, which is from Ingwe, because he talked about the cougars, I mean the big cats, the leopards, that ended up moving into suburban neighborhoods in Africa that would live in the little creek valleys in between neighborhoods that didn't even seem big enough to hold a leopard. And at night they would creep around the neighborhood and feed on cats and dogs and, you know, pilfer the odd antelope that came into suburbia also, and managed to live right there within 20 yards of homes that people lived in, and managed to live out their life like that without ever being seen. You know, and it's only the disappearance of cats and dogs that indicates that they're there at all. And Ingwe would be called in to kind of investigate these things, and he would find those cougars in there. The same thing was happening at Tiger Mountain. Within 20 yards of a trail that 150,000 hikers were using every year that were coming out from the Seattle area, we discovered the day lair, the core area, the secret spot of an old male cougar who basically, after each night's forays, he would go out into suburbia and prey on cats and dogs and raccoons, and occasionally over in Preston he'd get a goat or two, which made his presence known. You know, because when cats and dogs disappear, you know, people put signs all over the telephone poles here in Western Washington, but they might think in their mind someone stole it, right? So no one's really putting two and two together out here that all these cats and dogs that disappear on a continuous basis are evidence that we have cougars living right under our nose and we don't know they're there. You know, and it is the knowledge of bird language that helps us to figure out that they're in there in the first place. So when we tracked this cougar, we began to realize that all of its trails were more and more well worn in, to the point where there was one 175-foot long dug fir tree that had fallen over that had moss growing on the top because it had been laying over for a number of years, had worn in patches every 27 inches where that cougar placed its feet. That's how habitual it was as it got closer and closer to this area that it slept in by day, you know, and that all its trails pointed like spokes on a wheel, and they got more and more worn in as we got closer and closer to that area, that I stopped at that point, and I heard bird alarms down in that valley where the creek was falling off a steep hill, and I heard bird alarms down there, which meant that that cougar was aware we were approaching it, and it was starting to do sort of evasive behavior. It might have been pacing nervously, but it was definitely nervous, and it was crouching and looking, you know, and that's what caused the birds to alarm. You know, if that cougar was just lying and sleeping, they wouldn't even care. But the cougar was aware we were approaching, and it got nervous, and its nervousness broadcast intensity. The birds were drawn in, and they said, there's a cougar in here. And everything pointed to it anyway, you know. So we said, at that point, the trackers who were present that day, and then all the rest of us, we decided we would avoid that area from then on, you know, because that was its private area. So, you know know you're in there. We're not going to bother you anymore. We're just going to record that information and move on to the next thing. We gathered what we needed. We were comfortable. We knew it was an old male, you know, from tracking it and all those sorts of things. And word got back to the one of the managers, and he said, no, that's not possible. They couldn't know that. So he went, he said, where's that spot? You know, so one of our communicators told him where the spot was, and he walked to that spot in daylight. He parked his car and just kind of brazenly walked in, and sure enough, that cougar popped out, kind of walked out, looked at him, walked a few steps and turned and looked at him again as if to say, I thought you guys were going to leave me alone, you know, and then off he walked, you know, so that was an exciting moment for our team, you know, that we didn't really need that. I mean, I didn't need that, but I'm sure some of the people on the team were excited that, oh, wow, this is cool, it works, you know, but it was a combination of tracking ability and bird language that taught us that. So in the context of that, I just want to, you know, say that, you know, I've said it before in several different ways on this tape, that we're really just talking about ever more sophisticated ways of getting to know your place. And I reflect back on Stalking Wolf for a moment and some of the things that Tom has said growing up with Stalking Wolf as a mentor, what it takes to get to know your place to that level, the level of a scout. You know, remember the intense need that must be generated in order for that to happen. Stalking Wolf must have been a master need dispenser, I'll tell you, because Tom's abilities as a tracker are just phenomenal. But I remember him saying that grandfather made them track, first of all, there's sand roads everywhere in the Pine Barrens, so the first thing you learn is to identify all the footprints around you in the forest, you know, because you see them regularly. You see deer tracks on the sand road. That's pretty easy. Ah, deer tracks. I know what that looks like. Eventually, over time, you begin to be able to tell a walking deer from a deer that's trotting or ghosting, as I described before, and a deer that's bounding. Those are pretty obvious things. You figure that out over time, enough questioning, enough looking at those tracks. Eventually, you get the opportunity to see a deer do something like bend down to pick something up, pick a leaf, and then move on. Then you can run over and track it and see what it looks like when they do that. And remember that. You store it away in your mind. Eventually, you develop the ability to follow the deer when they leave the sand road and to be able to follow them through kind of challenging terrain. But it takes quite a long time. I mean, thousands of hours of actually tracking deer on sand roads and in easier terrain before you can start to track them as they move into harder and harder terrain to read. But it's a progression. You learn to do it over time. And at the same time, Stalking Wolf is coaxing Tom and Rick, and Tom was doing the same thing with me, you know, years later, to get to know all the other animals. First the skunks and the foxes, and the coyotes, the wild dogs, being able to tell a wild dog from a coyote, and eventually getting to know the jumping tracks of the junco and the running tracks of the robin, and being able to recognize a pine snake track, a turtle track, toad tracks, then mouse, then shrew, then weasel and mink, and just finding more and more difficult animals to track and trail. And then in time, Tom developed the ability under Stalking Wolf's mentoring to follow any animal across any terrain. You know, and at that point, as Tom says, he felt at that point that tracking couldn't get any better. You know, and just then Stalking Wolf introduced the concept of pressure releases, the ability to read subtle nuances in the body's condition, in the slight indents and marks and dents and cracks of the track itself, you know, and that's when the whole another universe opened up for him. And the same thing is going to happen to you with bird language. You know, you're out there, you have to know every bird in your area. You have to know them by, not so much, doesn't matter if you know the Latin name of that bird, that's not as important as that you know that that bird over there is Bob, the song sparrow, the male, and that hanging out with Bob this year is Sally, you know, and you're wondering what happened to Mary Jo, who had that very distinguishing brown mark on her one side. You know, she was the one that was with him last year and the year before. Well, she's gone now, but he's made it again, and now he's with this other female. You know, and then you're curious, how long will this one last? You know, does she have any wisdom? Will she make it through a season? You know, you're getting to know the birds of your yard that well, to that extreme, right? That's what you're after here. It's not random behavior that you're out there walking out for the first time and reading bird language, you know. You have to get to know them to that level, right? It's like following animals through any condition. That's when you can read the pressure releases. It's the same with bird language. The more you know your individual birds in your yard, the better you're able to read into the story. Does that make sense to you? This is a goal that you guys all have. So, and just remember that every species has this relative wisdom that we're talking about. The adolescent extreme, and on the other extreme, cougar medicine. So hummingbirds can have cougar medicine, you know, that thoughtful approach to life, you know, so watch that junco with that in mind in the future. If it keeps flying up, maybe it'll learn its hard lesson. Maybe it'll live through that, and then it'll never choose to fly up quite as high again. Okay, so I bring all of this information together. I think about Ingwe's story in his book called Ingwe and his tape, The Spirit of the Leopard. Same. It's the book on tape. He talks about this ancient leopard that he encountered in the forest in a very special manner that passed on the medicine of the leopard to Ingwe. You know, and it wasn't just a young leopard, an adolescent leopard, but it was an ancient leopard, one whose spots had darkened almost till they ran together, and the animal was almost black looking. It was so dark. It had been around for a very long time. You know, that spirit of ancient wisdom of the animals. I think of the animal that's the ultimate symbol of this in North America and in Northern Europe, and that's the wolf. And I want to highlight features about the wolf as the ultimate teacher of these skills. And again, as you're teaching younger people or thinking about it yourself, it's not a bad idea to put up some wolf posters around your house and to tell stories about wolves, ancient stories from native tribes in Ireland, native tribes in Scandinavia, from the Inuit, from the Apaches, from all across North America. There's legends and stories about wolves, and they're all the same. You tell these stories of this animal that the Apaches say they learned their scout skills from the wolf. You know, for instance, when wolves travel, sometimes they walk in single file, and they all place one foot right into the tracks of the wolf right in front of them. So if you're following them in the snow, you can tell there's more than one wolf, but you can't tell how many. And you're following them. I remember my friend was saying he followed them for about 2 miles through the snow. And they were continually, one track into the next, and he couldn't tell how many they were until they got to a certain location. Then they fanned out. And when they fanned out, they all fanned out into different gait lengths. You know, one had a 27-inch gait, one had a 30-inch gait, one had a 26-inch gait. That's the gait they were comfortable in. But when they were walking, they all matched the gait of the lead wolf. You know, so they're adjusting even their walking style so that they can be invisible, you know, that they can not leave a trail to tell how many there were. But there was 7 or 8 of them that fanned out from that single file trail. You know, these are the kinds of things that are sort of legendary but true. People who study wolves see this kind of stuff all the time. You know, who are these animals? They seem to have kind of gone beyond what we call cougar medicine because they don't do it alone. They do it in groups. You know, they actually move as a scout team. You know, they are the ultimate teachers of awareness. So let's look first at their intelligence for a second. And there's been studies done, and I think this is in the book of Wolves and Men. He talks about the intelligence of a house dog versus the intelligence of a wolf, and that the wolf is a much better problem solver, that a house dog can't even be trained to open a complex latch. You know, you have to train it to do things, whereas the wolf only watches the person who's opening the latch do it once, and the next minute the wolf's over there opening the latch with its nose in the same manner. You know, that kind of ability to observe, to see the pattern, to recognize it, to learn from it, and then to do it themselves. You know, that's intelligence. Wolves are known to be highly intelligent. It used to be believed that wolves were just dumb because they couldn't be trained, but some people after a while realized that it wasn't that they were dumb and couldn't be trained, it was just that they were too smart to put up with that kind of abuse. And they were impertinent. You know, they just wouldn't be trained. You know, they're just like, no way, you're not doing that to me. I'm not your slave. So that spirit. And wolves are highly efficient animals. When they move, they travel with such stealth and such perfection. Their tracks are like poetry of perfection. I have to say that because they place their feet in such a proper manner. Even when they're at high speeds, you know, the integrity of the foot itself, the integrity of the track pattern shows that they're the masters of energy conservation even while moving, that seems to be their whole mental process is about that. And I want to compare that for a second to cougars and bears. Cougars and bears master invisibility by traveling really, really slowly, by moving in dark and shadowy places, but wolves don't have that luxury. Right? Wolves might cover 35 miles in a night, so they're practicing invisibility and covering huge distances. And that's something that the scouts really looked to as a role model, because the scouts themselves, how successful could you be as a scout if it took you 2.5 hours to go 100 yards? You're not going to bring your tribe very useful information doing that, you know? So for the next 2 weeks, you only get a half a mile away, you know? So the scouts had to be like wolves also. They had to run long distances in silence in the night, in the darkness, and then pull the information and bring it back. So we know that pattern recognition is part of eyesight. It's also part of hearing. It's part of the sense of smell. The brain works on pattern recognition. Well, when we look at the way the eyesight of the wolf works, not only does a wolf focus and look at things and recognize patterns in close detail, which we might call tunnel vision, which we all practice in the modern world to learn to read and write, but they also have the ability to recognize patterns in their peripheral vision as well, which a scout also must develop. It's something that I had to develop. I had to be able to recognize bird language out of the corner of my eye, that the movement of that jay indicates that it's nervous about something right below it. And I just about passed that jay. And I turn and look at the jay, and I see that body language, and I look down, and I see that there's a deer in a day bed, kind of acting nervous as I'm passing by. So if I hadn't been using my peripheral vision to that extent, I wouldn't have recognized that. I would have missed that deer. These are the kinds of things that the wolf models also, that ability to see things out of the corner of their eye, recognize it, and instantly respond. So we look at that, the whole thing of light and shadow, how they love to move. They're crepuscular. They move at dawn and dark because that's the time when the light and shadow play tricks on them. But they're able to see through those illusions very well, and they're masters of that illusionary ability. Like the deer knows the limits of our vision, so does the wolf. It can always stay just on the edge. So the scout modeled that ability to stay just on the edge of sight. The same thing with their hearing. They hear in all directions. If you ever watch even a sleeping wolf or a coyote sleeping, their ears are following bird language even in their sleep. And it's sometimes that ear flips over and that's enough to cause that animal to lift its head. It's almost like they never quite really sleep. You know, at least one of them's always somewhat paying attention. Stalking wolf, by the way, got his name by creeping up on a sleeping wolf and touching it. That's how he got his name. So that's their hearing. And also remember, because they're problem solvers and because they have awesome hearing, bird language is a giant three-dimensional problem-solving ability, isn't it? You know, they're pattern recognizers. So they put together this whole bird language thing. And I noticed out on the sandbar when I had the opportunity to spend a summer with a family of wolves that birds treated them entirely differently than they treated coyotes. The coyotes always seemed to be up to no good. They always seemed to be anxious, and the birds responded to them in kind, whereas the wolves always seemed to be totally at ease. It's almost like they were the masters of all they surveyed, and they generated such confidence and such peace of mind. I noticed that they didn't disturb the singing of the birds the same way that the coyotes did or the way the bobcats did, because they had a whole different energy around them. They were more regal, more at peace. So I look at these birds, and I think about them in that, I mean, not the wolves in that manner, because of the reflections that they give back from the landscape around them, why they are the ultimate, you know, power and awareness. And the last thing that I think about with wolves is how all of their senses combine to create enormous instinctive ability. Because that's the one thing I've noticed in my own students. The more they practice all five senses, the sooner they develop a sixth sense or an instinctive and intuitive response to the things around them. And wolves must be the master of that because their eyesight is amazing, their hearing is amazing, and their sense of smell is beyond imagination. So how does all of that come together? That's why that animal to the scouts symbolizes the greatest role model, the greatest teacher. They're the most like the people, and the people can learn most from them, which is not to say we won't learn from every other animal out there. But when you're teaching the next generation, tell them about the wolf and honor the wolf and its great intelligence and power and beauty. And you'll really inspire them. So that's good for now. And in our last tape, we're going to talk about how all of this relates to the development of instinct in a kind of specific manner. The meaning of Dawah.